This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just yesterday, General Motors was all but finished, done in by debt it couldn't renegotiate. 24 hours later, with the offer a little bit sweeter, well, GM is still teetering on the brink, but the lenders are going to be better off. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice, over 10,000 independent insurance agencies across America committed to treating customers as people, not policies, online at TrustedChoice.com. American Public Media programs explore the American dream and ask, after our current troubles are over, what's next? More at NextAmericanDream.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 28th of May. Great to have you here. And flashback to yesterday with me for a minute, would you? Recall that the offer General Motors made to the lenders to whom it owes $27 billion was to swap that debt for 10% of the company. Bondholders said no dice, so this morning GM went back to the well, 10% with an option to buy another 15% if the lenders don't object to a bankruptcy filing. One group of big bondholders took that deal this morning. The rest of them have till Saturday to decide. An agreement wouldn't necessarily put off a bankruptcy. It would, though, make GM's trip through Chapter 11 a whole lot easier. Meanwhile, the major U.S. carmaker that's already in bankruptcy might be getting out a lot sooner than anybody, including yours truly, never thought. Just a month after it filed, Chrysler is wrapping up its bankruptcy proceedings in New York. But Marketplace's Amy Scott reminds us, now comes the hard part.
Outside the U.S. courthouse in Manhattan today, reporters awaited Chrysler's impending exit from bankruptcy. Chrysler will have shed billions of dollars in debt and labor costs, and it will emerge with a new partner, the Italian automaker Fiat. But it could be 2 years before Fiat's smaller cars hit the U.S. market. Analyst Lori Harber-Felax says that's what Chrysler needs.
Where they really lack is on the car side, and that's really what Fiat is supposed to replace. And that can't happen soon enough because people are buying cars today, and they're buying smaller cars.
There's also the recession. Credit is tight, and people are reluctant to buy cars at all. Industry consultant Marianne Keller says to survive, Chrysler will need cash. But after some of its lenders took a back seat to the United Auto Workers in bankruptcy, Keller says financing may be hard to come by.
Ordinarily, some of that money would come from the capital markets and the private sector. In the case of Chrysler, with UAW ownership representing, you know, a little bit more than half of the business, that's not going to happen.
One former Chrysler executive told me it can't get much worse than what the company's already been through. But other news today spelled more trouble for all the Detroit Three. Two parts suppliers filed for bankruptcy, including Ford's biggest supplier, Visteon. That's bound to hurt the one automaker that hasn't needed a bailout. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Attention, AOL.
You've got mail.
Sadly, it's marked return to sender. After almost 10 years of trying to combine forces into an internet-era powerhouse, Time Warner is going to spin off its AOL division. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains why the much-celebrated media marriage never did work out. When Giddy, Time Warner, and AOL executives sealed their deal at the very peak of the dot-com bubble, they couldn't seem to hold back on their self-congratulatory superlatives.
I don't think it's too much to say this really is a historic moment.
From books to videos to financial services to travel to communications, you name it, the possibilities combining our brands are endless.
Even Time Warner board member Ted Turner, never known for his understatement, seemed to top himself that day, announcing his stamp of approval.
I did it with as much or more excitement and enthusiasm as I did on that night when I first made love some 42 years ago.
Within months, the burst of the dot-com bubble left investors with billions in losses, and recently Time Warner had searched in vain for a buyer for AOL. What went wrong? For one thing, Time Warner took on a dial-up service just when web surfers were switching in droves to high speed. And Richard Morgan, assistant managing editor at The Deal, says the high price was wrong from the start.
Back then, a lot of people were drinking the Kool-Aid about the new economy. When they announced that they were going to create the deal of the century, they put the value at $166 billion. Today, the market cap of Time Warner, which contains AOL, is only $28 billion. So that's a loss that's greater than 80%.
Morgan says it also put a long list of executives out of work.
It'd be hard to top this in terms of ruining both investments and careers.
Possibly ranking it, Morgan says, as the worst deal of the century. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Since Massachusetts overhauled its healthcare system in 2006, the state has gotten almost universal insurance coverage. But a new study shows that the program, which is supposed to cut health costs, does come at a price. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
The survey found that more residents than ever had access to healthcare in 2008, but they had a harder time paying the bills. And low-income patients had trouble getting in to see specialists. The physicians either weren't taking new patients or weren't accepting the type of health insurance they had. John Kingsdale is with Massachusetts Health Connector, the agency that helps residents find health care. He says now that the state has conquered universal coverage, it has to improve on cost and quality.
Once you solve part of this very complex set of problems, you then probably exacerbate some other problems and need to focus. And so that's exactly what we're doing in Massachusetts.
The state program requires companies to make fair and reasonable contributions to employee health care, and residents have to buy their own insurance if they can afford it. The state plan is touted as a model for national health care reform, but the survey found that the program fails to address one of the major contributors to rising health care costs, people who use the emergency room when they can't afford to see a doctor. Bill Roper is CEO of the University of North Carolina healthcare system. It serves low-income patients, many of them uninsured.
We're drowning in a tidal wave of indigent care. We have lots of customers, and some of them pay us.
Roper says even with its flaws, the Massachusetts system is far better than healthcare in the rest of the country. The survey was published in the journal Health Affairs. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the fear largely went out of the bond market. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Cleveland Cavaliers are on the bubble tonight in their NBA playoff series against Orlando. The Cavs are down 3-1. And if they can't pull it out, Nike and Glossow Vitamin Water would be among the losers, too. For months, those two companies have been banking on a hypothetical matchup between Cleveland's LeBron James and Kobe Bryant of the Los Angeles Lakers, assuming both teams make it to the NBA Finals. Joel Rose reminds us that advertisers love a good rivalry, even if they have to make one up.
In the Vitamin Water ad, fans in L.A. and Cleveland argue back and forth about who's better, LeBron or Kobe.
Inside. Water. Outside.
Handles like a dream.
Man's a nightmare to cover.
The ad doesn't mention the NBA Finals by name, but it still sends the message that basketball's two biggest stars are poised to meet on the league's biggest stage for the first time.
That's always what brands are looking for, is to be relevant with their consumers, and there's probably no more relevant story in the NBA right now.
Paul Swangard teaches sports marketing at the University of Oregon. He says advertisers find that kind of drama irresistible.
You'd almost be silly not to fan the flames of that emotion because it just continues to connect your brand to that excitement.
Nike also has a high-profile ad campaign starring LeBron and Kobe as puppets. The hype has apparently been good for the league. TV ratings for the playoffs are up more than 10% over last year. But if the marquee matchup doesn't happen, advertisers can wind up looking silly. Just ask Reebok.
Dan can throw a discus 172 feet. Dave can long jump 24 feet.
Reebok spent millions hyping the showdown between Dan O'Brien and Dave Johnson at the 1992 Barcelona Olympics. Only Dan didn't wind up qualifying for the U.S. Olympic team. Industry observers say advertisers have probably learned from that mistake. Ben Sterner is CEO of The Leverage Agency, a sports marketing firm.
I'm sure Nike has a plan B. They're smart. They're not putting all their eggs in one basket.
Still, it's a safe bet advertisers will be rooting for the Cavs tonight. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
I'm going to go way out on a limb here and guess that not too many of you have heard of a 30-year-old Canadian thrash metal band called Anvil. Lots of heavy metal groups you probably do know really respect them, though. They inspired bands like Guns N' Roses and Metallica. Malcolm Dome writes for a magazine called Metal Hammer.
If you actually had to choose one band and one album that really started the whole ball rolling, it would be Metal on Metal and it would be Anvil.
Catchy tune, I know, but Anvil somehow never really got off the ground. Now, though, on the strength of a new documentary, we pulled that Malcolm Dome cut from it, the band is enjoying the success their fans say is long overdue. It's a turnaround they can credit to a struggling cable channel, a couple of popular recording artists, and everybody's favorite new social media site. Claude Brodesser-Ackner is the L.A. Bureau Chief for Advertising Age magazine. And when we sat down to talk about this, I asked him how a documentary about thrash metal could possibly stand a chance.
This movie has two bullets in the head right from the start. It's a documentary and thrash metal. I mean, so right there, it's got its hurdles. On top of that, it has no studio support for probably the reasons we just articulated.
All right, well then, how is this film succeeding, as to the degree it is, without any major studio support?
Well, what happened was this. VH1 purchased the broadcast television and DVD rights to Anvil, the story of Anvil, which is this documentary. And so while they're not in any way sort of responsible for the theatrical release, they are heavily incentivized to make sure it's a successful one.
Incentivized in what way?
Because the better it does in theaters, the better it does on DVD.
All right, so how do they make it work then?
They started handing it out on a DVD to various VH1 stars, John Mayer, people like Joel and Benji Madden from Good Charlotte. And these are people who have tremendous followings on Twitter, which is the free social networking
140 characters or less in
regular
economics.
And, you know, had you to purchase the kind of exposure that they have through Twitter, you'd have spent many, many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Let me make sure I have this right. What VH1 did was distribute these free copies to these music stars who have Twitter accounts, the hope being that they would then Twitter, their followers would retweet and go see the movie, and everything would sort of happen. Total cash out of pocket to VH1 is probably like $20 for making the DVDs, right?
If that much. You know, there's no real way to quantify the value of Twitter media. That is, when you buy a banner ad on RollingStone.com, you know you're going to get X many impressions. Right. But it's just not the same thing as someone who you follow and maybe, you know, deeply, deeply interested in. When they tweet something, that's like a tap on the shoulder.
Is there anything in this for the tweeters? I mean, are John Mayer and those guys getting a little extra airplay from VH1 for doing this?
No. And in fact, VH1 has been very, 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 I underline that five times, assiduous about emphasizing that this can blow up in your face, that you cannot do this sort of thing for I Love New York or some sort of Flavor Flav show, nor can it seem as though these people have been given blandishments to tweet. This has to be a sort of spontaneous, earned media experience rather than a media buy.
So are people at the major studios sitting there going, VH1 did this. I wonder if it could work for us.
Well, if Twitter winds up becoming the sort of cream-skimming device for smaller cultural happenings, that's a very interesting model, because Hollywood has pretty much all but abandoned the serious documentary film or the serious art film.
What about the traditional documentary audience, though, which I would imagine skews older, isn't necessarily online, doesn't necessarily tweet?
You don't have to worry about making sure that people over 50 go see a documentary. In a sense, that's the low-hanging fruit. I was talking to Bingham Ray, who was the first executive to market successfully a major documentary, and that was Bowling for Columbine, which made $20 million. He said, we could have made millions more had we spent millions more. But there's a point of diminishing returns on documentaries. And for this film, I'm kind of actually hoping that they don't wind up spending any television money, because this will be the case study to find out what's a tweet really worth.
Claude Brodesser-Actor is the LA Bureau Chief for Advertising Age. Claude, thanks a lot.
Guy, it's a pleasure.
Fittingly, we go out with Anvil playing Metal on Metal. We've got clips from the documentary if you want to see them. They're on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, enough heavy metal. Who says banking isn't exciting?
We somehow think we should be cosseted away from risk. It's a bit like these current markets, I think a lot of our lives actually are devalued by not having risk in them.
But first, let's do the numbers. Worries over long-term interest rates that sank the market yesterday eased up some today. The Dow rallied 103 points, gained 1.25%, closed at 8,403. The Nasdaq bounced back 20 points, 1.2%, finished at 1751. The S&P 500 rebounded 13 points, 1.5%, wrapped up the day at 906. Energy stocks led the way as oil prices closed above $65 a barrel for the first time in 6 months. Valero Energy shares surged nearly 3.75%. Stock in ConocoPhillips pumped up 2.5%. Chevron gained almost 2%. ExxonMobil spurted 1.33% higher. Bond prices rallied, easing fears about long-term borrowing costs. As I mentioned, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note slipped to 3.62%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the First 5 Years Fund, working to expand early learning for the nation's most at-risk children and provide benefits for society. FFYF.org. And by the University of Chicago Booth School of Business and its 57th Annual Management Conference, with faculty debating the future of markets, May 29th, chicagobooth.edu. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at the events for Friday. The Commerce Department lets us know what gross domestic product looked like in first quarter. Education Secretary Arne Duncan speaks at the National Press Club. And President Obama is expected to release a report on cybersecurity policy in the U.S. The review looks at how federal agencies use technology to protect data. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Tens of thousands of people who used to work on Wall Street have lost their jobs since the bottom fell out of the banking sector. That's tens of thousands of people who are reasonably bright, good with numbers, and looking for work. If they can stomach a relatively paltry $130,000 a year salary and, pass a lie detector test, the CIA has some openings. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
This week, Bloomberg Radio started running an unusual employment ad aimed at disillusioned Wall Street types.
If the quest for the bottom line is just not enough for you, the Central Intelligence Agency has a mission like no other. Join CIA's Directorate of Intelligence and be a part of our global mission.
Ron Patrick is a CIA recruiter. He says the work is challenging and vital.
Our economic analysts are looking at counterterrorism. They're looking at counterproliferation issues, crime issues, drug issues.
And he's looking for a few top minds, even if the CIA can't pay top dollar.
Well, typically not as much as a hedge fund.
Pay ranges from $85,000 to $130,000 a year, but it beats nothing. and the CIA's Wall Street recruitment drive as part of the agency's increased focus on the economy. This winter, the agency started a daily briefing for President Obama on the global impact of the economic crisis, and it's been tracking terrorist financing for years. Jimmy Garule oversaw those kinds of investigations after 9/11.
The real question is there a national strategy in place to deal with these types of financial issues?
Garule says no, and the intelligence community needs to do better on everything from tracking the opium trade to anticipating more economic chaos. Some of Wall Street's refugees could help, so if you just lost that sweet gig at a hedge fund,
take the next step.
Apply online at the CIA. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The global economy might be the classic instance of the sum of the parts being more than the whole. Huge industries built on the work of individual employees. Today on our series, Working, we take you inside one of the world's most unpopular industries at the moment, banking and international finance. Not all bankers are bad guys, of course, but the financial crisis has thrown new light on the seamier side of that business. Our story starts last August, before words like bailout and stress test were in common usage. Marketplace's Sean Cole went to London for our profile.
So the purpose of this series is to understand the global economy one worker and one job at a time. And with Brandon Davies, that was a bit of a problem.
How many jobs do you have?
That's an interesting question, actually.
Here we go.
I work for a bank called Gatehouse, owned by Kuwaiti interests, and another bank in London being opened up with Nigerian interests. I write things. I have investment and trading.
Brandon had six or seven different jobs and seven laptops, each with its own secure network. On top of everything he listed, when I met him, he was still the head of the Global Association of Risk Professionals, GARP, a nonprofit group that helps financial risk managers all over the world do what they do better. And though he's an expert on risk, his office had glass walls.
But why so many jobs?
I'll be honest with you, I worked for the same company, Barclays Bank, for 32 years.
He started in the trading room at Barclays and later ran the company's treasury. And then, about 5 years ago,
I retired, and then I very quickly got very bored, and I asked myself what I wanted to do, and I thought, well, I'd like to do a whole load of things.
It all started with a book he wrote.
Which is over here, actually. It's the Certificate in Banking Risk and Regulation. That's the Indonesian classic.
I read that on my bedside table.
Well, there's about 50,000 Indonesians who read it, because they have to.
Indonesian bankers, that is. The book teaches them how to adhere to a global set of standards for how much capital banks should have in reserve, how much risk they should expose themselves to. And this may sound like run-of-the-mill policy stuff, but Brandon says banks have a moral obligation to help emerging markets like Indonesia by growing small businesses there.
Because at the end of the day, you can't just charity people out of poverty. There's too many of them. You've got to grow those economies to a size where people naturally come out of poverty. There has been a dramatic...
I didn't think a banker could be so idealistic, nor so thoughtful about his job. Everything Brandon does revolves around risk in some way, but he thinks about risk in more than just financial terms. And I didn't fully realize this...
...from people who may deposit it. Brandon Davies.
...until his mechanic called.
Oh, hi, Steve.
One of his Porsches had gone wrong. Again. Brandon is the only person I've met who owns two Porsches.
So that sounds dreadful, doesn't it?
I have never driven a Porsche.
Oh, it's a new one is an incredibly efficient machine, but lacks a lot of that character that the old ones had.
Which he realized is a metaphor for the nature of risk writ large.
There is something missing in our lives that was once there in every day. Our lives were actually much more dangerous. But maybe that adds quite a lot to life, makes you live it a bit more. Whereas we somehow think we should be cosseted away from risk. It's a bit like these current markets, you know. I think a lot of our lives actually are devalued by not having risk in them. Yeah? We devalue the meaning of life.
From his offices at GARP, Brandon took me out to meet some of his colleagues at the other jobs. They were all a few blocks from each other in London's financial area.
I've never seen so many banks in one place.
There's lots. There's thousands.
We headed into Gatehouse Bank, where he's the senior independent non-executive director. Basically, he makes sure the bank is doing right by its shareholders and other stakeholders.
Hi, James.
James Bagshaw, the CFO, joined us in the boardroom, telling me how new the bank was and that it dealt with Islamic financial instruments. And while we were chatting, Brennan snuck out of the room.
Who knows what...
I'm just going off to see the CEO. So.
Who knows what the world's going to throw at us next, but if you've got good people, you've got a pretty good chance of dealing with change.
Is he a good person?
He is, yeah.
But when I asked if I could follow Brandon, listen in on his meeting, they said the topic was too sensitive.
And I'm just sort of waiting for them to come out. And I really wish I knew what they were talking about. The lobby's very nice.
This happened over and over again. Here I was supposed to document an international banker at work, and yet I wasn't allowed to watch him do any of his jobs. And I had to ask him.
Do you think it's a secretive world, the financial world or the world of banking?
Yes, I think it is. But I don't think it's secretive for a sinister purpose. You'll probably find a lot of people willing to tell you how they make decisions, the process. But if you're using all this to try and make money, why would you tell everybody else exactly what decisions you're making, you know?
And there's a lot of money to be made in this business. Brennan can clear $750,000 in a good year. And bad years aren't so bad either. But he doesn't need any more money. All four kids are grown and living on their own. He said he does it because it's fun.
It's like a big puzzle, yeah. It's kind of the ultimate bit of crossword puzzle or Sudoku, isn't it? You know, it's the ultimate brain teaser.
The world's fourth biggest investment bank, Lehman Brothers, is near to insolvency.
Breaking news here. Stocks all around the world are tanking because of the crisis on Wall Street.
Well, we may have two more companies.
Just days after I got back to the States, the banking crisis really took hold. By the time I finally got back to Brandon, the ground had shifted in the banking world. I had to wonder how things had changed for him. I took a deep breath, called him up, and was surprised to find him doing yet another job.
I've started a business which is concerned with helping people set up small banks in the United Kingdom. And that business has taken off remarkably rapidly.
I just find that so impossible. Like, we've been reading about all these banks failing and going down, and your job is actually helping new banks set up.
Well, I think if you think of capitalism as a process of creative destruction, maybe it's not so silly, you know.
Brandon says we tend to look at the U.S. and the U.K. as the end-all be-all of international finance, but it's called the global economy for a reason. His first two clients are Indian and Chinese money transfer companies that plan to open banks, small banks. That's the prescription, he says. Decentralize the risk. The bad outcomes, when they inevitably happen, won't be as dire. And as an aside, banking might not be as reviled.
My wife keeps telling me that she now tells people I'm a real estate. I think you call them realtors.
There has, of course, been a lot of backlash against bankers during this whole crisis. And Brandon knows that's for good reason. Just like he's sheepish about owning two Porsches, he's a little sheepish about his whole profession now. But he understood the risks when he got into it.
Sean went to London to report that story for us. Our series, Working, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. You can see pictures of Brandon Davies and hear all the other working profiles that we've done on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, proof that somebody still loves General Motors. The mayor of Warren, Michigan wants GM to abandon its downtown Detroit headquarters and move the 20 or so miles out to the suburbs. Mayor Jim Fouts points out that the company's already got a tech center out in Warren, and it comes with 30 years' worth of tax breaks. GM CEO Fritz Henderson said last month he's not opposed to a move necessarily, but it's not on top of his list because, you know, he's got that whole bankruptcy thing to worry about. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday. Today, the Dow rose 103 points, 1.25%. The NASDAQ added 20 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 gained 13 points. That's 1.5%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. Coming up next time, social media makes its way into the workplace.
You almost feel like if you're not on Facebook, you're doing something wrong. Everyone on IBM is on Facebook, and it's not just my level or my age range. It's all the way up the chain.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.